any business before this honorable Supreme Court of CMOA, draw a line. Give your attention and it shall be heard.
Please call the case.
Case number SCWC-17-87, State v. Abrigo. Arguing for the petitioner, Susan Arnett. Arguing for the respondent, Brian R. Vincent. Argument on the merits.
All right. Good morning, Ms. Arnett and Mr. Vincent. Are you both ready to proceed today? All right. Ms. Vincent, you'll go first, and you've reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal. We'll give you a warning with 5 minutes to go. And your argument? I'm sorry, Ms. Arnett. I apologize. I'm so sorry. Ms. Arnett, you'll have a warning with 5 minutes to go. Mr. Vincent, a warning for you as well with 5 minutes to go. I apologize.
Thank you.
Ms. Arnett.
Chief Justice Reckonwald, Associate Justices of the Supreme Court, I am Deputy Public Defender Susan Arnett, representing defendant appellant.
Could you pull the mic closer just again so we can be sure to hear? Thank you.
No one ever accused me of not being able to be heard. I represent defendant appellant petitioner Nino Abrigo. The question before the court is whether the Intermediate Court of Appeals gravely erred in holding that the trial court did not err in denying Mr. Abrigo's motion to strike Officer Ostachuk's testimony related to the standardized field sobriety test and the traffic violations charged against Mr. Abrigo because the officer lacked present recollection of the events. And I'd like to start with the premise that if there is something in our application for cert that we do not have time to get to an argument, we do still include it as a matter on which we rely. It's our position that the ICA gravely erred because the state did not lay adequate foundation under even 802.14 for admission of the officer's testimony regarding the field sobriety test. The state concedes in their answering brief that Officer Ostachuk did not have a present recollection of the arrest and of giving the field sobriety test to Mr. Abrigo when he testified on December 15th and December 30th. The state further concedes in their answering brief that Officer Ostachuk did not have a present recollection of the events when he testified on August 1st.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but are you clear, Ms. Arnett, in the record that the judge, on the other hand, did find that there was a present recollection?
It's not entirely clear what the judge did find. He certainly found that there was to admit that testimony, but his role in the case is disturbing. First of all, if you look at the events of August 1st, the state is taking the officer through the testimony as one might, having him talk about the events of May 15th, 2016, the date of the arrest, and also when he gets to the point of having pulled the car over and he's ready to administer the field sobriety test, there's going to be the issue about his training and ability, qualifications to do that. The court interrupts and says, well, I have this handy stipulation here if you'd like to use it, and defense if you'd like to agree to it. And then there are pages of discussions back and forth about it, and it's an extremely well-written, well-thought-out, comprehensive stipulation, which should have been thought of and presented by the state, not by the court. The court then says at one point that there's never been anything inconsistent in the officer's testimony. That's one of the court's findings. And that's simply not true. When the officer was finishing his testimony on August 1st, he was asked about how the defendant did on the turning part of the walk and turn. And was there any problem in doing the turning? And he said, not that I can recall. It was ordinary. Nothing out of the ordinary were his exact words. If there had been, I would have noted it in my report. On December 15th, when they pick up again, the first thing the prosecutor does is say, now let's go back to the walk and turn. That's where we left off. And we were talking about I was asking you about the turning. What can you tell us about that? And now he recites, he staggered a little bit at that point when he turned. He had to bend both knees, and that's what they do when they're about to lose their balance. So he did that. He adds all this information that completely contradicts the testimony he gave on August 1st, that there was nothing out of the ordinary and there was no problem with how Mr. Abrego did the turning part of the walk and turn.
Didn't,
so it's not even correct to say that the officer had no inconsistencies.
And in that regard, I'm sorry, CJ, while I was on that point, that in that regard, wasn't there a point at which defense counsel was trying to ask about the recollection of the officer with respect to walking, where the question was, do you actually remember that he stopped walking? And then the court, sua sponte, interjected?
Yes, and the court was wrong in that instance, too, because the question was fine. There was nothing confusing about the question. There was no objection to the question. The court says, okay, stop, because your question is misleading, which it was not. Then they have a discussion for a couple of pages about whether they're going to take this at the bench or have the witness leave the courtroom. So they have the witness leave the courtroom, and then they carry on with the discussion. And the court says, well, I've forgotten what your question was because, you know, we had to have the conversation with the witness. But, you know, there's something misleading here. And then they go on to deal with that.
But what significance does that have, that the judge sort of stopped the questioning and made a couple of statements?
This is what the court says to defense counsel during this discussion. The question was asked something to the effect of, was your prior testimony because you remembered it, or do you not remember it today? That was not the question. So you kind of blurred them. And then he goes on about, there's this distinction about August 1st testimony, December 15th testimony. And the court says, it's not perfectly clear right now to me what he's answering, because he tends to accept your statements as to his prior testimony, and I'm pretty sure he's doing so without even thinking. There's no evidence of that. There's no evidence. At no point does the witness say, I'm confused by your questions, I don't understand your questions, judge, can you help me? None of that.
The judge is in the courtroom, though, and he's looking at the witness, and he can judge what the witness's expressions are. Is in a better place than us on a cold transcript to take a look at it. But more to Justice Wilson's question, what's the significance of it in the context of the issues on appeal now?
The significance is looking at the totality of the circumstances of the court's dealing with this case and findings in this case. Because the court goes on to say that, you know, I take really good notes. I think I take better notes than attorneys. I took really good notes on the walk and turn, yet he did not notice the inconsistent. And then he says about the witness, this is a witness who is still in direct examination. I'm sorry, who has just begun cross-examination. My view of him, as far as I can tell, he's an honest guy. Okay, he's apparently from demeanor. He's assessing that as to credibility. I'm dubious that he remembers his prior testimony, but who knows? He's accepting blindly whatever you tell him he testified to. I know that. I believe that.
Was the trial over? I mean, are you telling me the judge was actually evaluating witness testimony while the trial was going on?
Yes. Repeatedly. And then the court goes on to say, and this, I believe, will address your question, Justice Nakayama. The question's not what he remembers today. The question is, when he testified last time, was he testifying based on a present memory then, or was he not? And our position is that the question is completely, what did he remember on December 15th? Because that's when cross-examination began. And we are urging this court to take another look at State v. De Los Santos and the precursors to De Los Santos, because to say that the mere appearance of a witness at trial cancels out any problem with confrontation. He's available for cross-examination, despite the fact that his answers to all of the questions put to him by defense counsel about the specifics of the field sobriety test were, I don't know, I don't recall, I'm not aware of that. And when he would be asked, well, did you remember it when you were testifying in great detail on August 1st? Or had you reviewed your report and memorized what was in your report? And he gave very vague answers to those questions. He kept saying, well, I'm going to refer you back to my previous answer.
And his previous answer was, and this is the witness the judge found credible, I remember coming to court on August 1st. I remember I testified. I remember we stopped at walk and turn, and that's all I remember. Okay. I remember nothing else about what I testified to.
We wouldn't get to the Confrontation Clause issue unless we found that the testimony was admissible, though, correct, under the rules of evidence. And that is your first issue, whether there was a substantial foundation laid, or do you think we should go directly to the Confrontation Clause?
Well, being who I am, I think you should go directly to the Confrontation.
Very well. Well, let's humor me and talk about the rule. So your view is that there. So the ICA, the state, apparently, although it seems that the trial court felt that the initial testimony was based on personal recollection, present recollection, the state seemed to back off of that analysis and did not support it on appeal, and the idea of past recollection recorded was advanced by the state and then adopted by the ICA. So what of the foundational elements, which is the one that you think is problematic and why?
They're all problematic, but the one that's the most problematic is 803B8, the public record exception to the hearsay rule. It specifically exempts, in criminal cases, police reports for a very good reason. And interestingly, in the discussion about these rules, they talk about why. Why is that important? And they mention the example of if a corporation hired an investigator to check out some event that happened that they might have liability for. And the investigator wrote the report, all with an eye, interviewed witnesses, et cetera, towards writing the report as to put the corporation in the best light possible. That would not be the sort of public record that should be admitted in lieu of testimony. Because it's written for court, it's written with a bias, and it does not have the indicia of reliability that payroll records or regularly kept business records, bills of lading, that sort of thing, would have. In this case, we have what is in essence a professional witness. He's a police officer. His job is to patrol the streets, looking for traffic infractions, responding to reports of crime. And on May 15th, he found what he believed to be a traffic infraction. He pulled the driver over, and then he believed he had a situation of somebody operating a vehicle under the influence.
Could I just follow up on that? So this officer testified he might have done 50 to 100 stops between the time of the arrest here and the time he was testifying, I believe, the second time. Is it what if the officer simply has so many cases that they can't, even with the report refreshing their recollection, they say this doesn't, I have so many cases, I cannot recall, other than I write my reports accurately, and I realize he may not have offered that testimony here, but why is that, in that situation, why not allow reference to a prior past recollection recorded? Do you think that was actually 803.8 intended to go that far?
Yes, I do. If that was allowed, then that's what every police officer would do. They would testify, as this officer did on direct examination, in great detail. How many steps did he take on the walk and turn test? Well, he was supposed to take 9, but he took 10 on the way. And on the way back, he took 8. And he stopped 3 times on the way there and 4 times on the way back. And on the holding the leg up, standing on one leg test, he put his leg down 3 times, and he hopped this many times,
Ms.
Et cetera,
Arnett,
et cetera.
Would your proposition apply to a lab report that is not what you say written in a biased way, but a lab report that indicated a DNA match or something like that?
I think that might be something that would have to be determined at trial based on the totality of the evidence, but In essence, basically, a lab report can be confirmed. You know, it can be the substance can be tested again. It can be tested by a different laboratory. So that's not the subjective information that's coming from a police officer,
right,
about 2 a.m.
Absolutely, it's not. So, but it is considered part of a police report. So you're not saying that all parts of a police report should not be accepted under the past recollection recorded, are you?
Yes.
What about
that's what the rule says.
Well, Ms. Arnett, isn't there, I think what Justice Nakayama is talking to you is something related but a little bit different. I mean, courts come down differently on what is a matter observed. For example, some courts say if it's an evaluative lab report, that's one thing. But if it's just a recordation of cars passing through, counting cars or something, that may not be it. But the question here is something different. This is an evaluative assessment made by a police officer, and clearly that is covered by the public records exception.
It is covered. And getting back to Chief Justice Reckonwald's question, our concern is that a police officer would be able to testify in significant detail on direct examination and on cross-examination claim a lack of memory, thereby not being subject to confrontation regarding what he testified to on direct. He could say, I did it off of the report and I don't remember. It didn't refresh my recollection. And regarding whether police officers should be expected to remember, yes, they should. And if they can't, they need better training.
So, well, I'm sorry, Justice McKenna.
I'm sorry, Justice Nakayama.
So in other words, the exception, the public aid public records exception, where it recites, doesn't include all criminal, all police reports. It says, in criminal cases, as Justice Pollack mentioned, matters observed by police officers and other law enforcement personnel. That's what you're arguing today should be excluded based on this public records non-exception.
And we know that there are, for example...
So you wouldn't include lab records or lab reports because they're not matters observed by police officers.
It would depend on the test that was done, because if the test was an evaluation that required an observation by the tester, then it might come under that umbrella. Mm.
So somebody doing a complex lab analysis with, you know, results going out to like the sixth decimal point, does, you know, dozens of them a day, hundreds a year, can't honestly say when they look at their report that their recollection is refreshed by the report, at least to that level of detail, that testimony can't come in, or that report can't come in?
Again, it would depend on the nature of the evaluation that was done. If it was simply, if this is a test, and if this stick turns blue, it means there's the presence of X in the substance that I tested.
Isn't that a matter observed? Well, why isn't it a matter observed? I guess
there's a good reason I'm not a doctor, and it's because I didn't do well in science. So I'm not aware of whether the blue stick could be in gradations of blue to suggest that maybe it isn't the substance that you're saying that it is. But if so, I would expect that an ethical tester would note that in their report, that it was marginally so. And that it's an inconclusive result or something of that nature. Therefore, if it's simply a test that tests something and it's not based on personal observations that need to be subject to cross-examination, then perhaps that would not come in. But I don't think there's been a huge deluge of cases where people have been objecting to lab reports using 803B8.
Well, not yet. But well, if what you say goes through, aren't all lab reports based on some sort of observation, whether it's of a machinery readout or test readout? There's always some sort of personal observation.
Well, I don't think so. When a blood pressure machine takes blood pressure, it just gives the numbers back.
And somebody's got to look at it and write it down, right? They don't actually put the tape of the blood pressure.
Well, they can attach the tape if they want to into the report. I don't think something like that would necessarily raise 803B8, but the situation in this case does. And what our concern is here regarding De Los Santos and Fields and that line of cases is that, you know, if you think back to State v. Kim, where experts were allowed to testify to, an expert in that case was allowed to testify that he believed the child complainant in a sex assault case. He believed the child was telling the truth. And interestingly, when that case was overturned in State v. Batongan, what one of the Supreme Court justices said at the time is to the prosecutor was, we gave you State v. Kim and you guys abused it. And that's what we think is happening in the line of cases.
I have a question along those lines in terms of the availability, unavailability. I'm wondering, can you explain to me why, for purposes of 804, the hearsay rule, a witness is considered unavailable if the witness testifies to a lack of memory of the subject matter? In other words, for purposes of the rules of evidence, a witness is unavailable if the witness doesn't remember. But for purposes of the confrontation clause, we have said that a witness is available even if the witness doesn't have memory. So why should there be a lower bar for the Constitution?
Our position is there shouldn't, and that's the problem. If we stick with De Los Santos, then what the ICA said in this case, witness was there. End of inquiry. We don't look beyond that. And the problem with that is not only, and of course most significantly, the fact that it denies the protections of the Confrontation Clause to a defendant, it's also that it flies in the face of evidentiary rules like 803b8 and doesn't in any way comport to accommodate those rules or look for some indicia of reliability other than just the officer saying it's in my report. And in this case, by the way, the officer did, and it may have been on December 30th when the trial was concluded, that he believed that he was most likely relying on the report when he testified on August 1st. So there is a basis for the state conceding that he was not testifying from memory.
Actually,
even on August 1st.
Didn't the officer say he'd had a distinct recollection of stopping him and his car and it being kind of a show car? So I think what you're saying is a little bit overbroad, that he didn't have any memory. Let me be more specific.
He said that as to the standardized field sobriety tests, he believed his testimony on August 1st was based on his report and not on his memory. And it's that evidence that we seek to have stricken in this case, and that we really believe the ICA gravely erred in not deciding that the trial court should have stricken it.
Can I interrupt you at that point and ask for your thoughts, Ms. Arnett, about State versus Bloss? Because the ICA seemed to rely on State versus Bloss. That's a case in which past recollection recorded was established, and what had happened is a police officer was able to read a citation because, and this goes back to what the Chief Justice was saying about the extent to which past recollection recorded may be established because some of the details are remembered. And in that case, I think the officer remembered some of the details about the stop and then based on that was allowed to read this as past recollection recorded with the understanding that it was, I guess, accurate.
I think that State v. Bloss can easily be distinguished. What was significant in that case was that the officer gave this defendant two parking citations, one on March 28, 1980, and one on March 31, 1980, 3-day difference. Both were at 7 a.m., both at the same general location. So the officer testified at the trial on the March 28th citation, and he remembered everything. He said, I followed my practice of always calling the dispatcher when I write the citation to ask what time is it. He did not remember details from March 31st, but because it was so close in time to March 28th, because he testified about his practice and how he did these things, and most significantly, because he testified that he wrote the citation contemporaneously with the events. There is no testimony in this case that the officer wrote his report, checked off boxes, did anything contemporaneously with the event. The ICA says there is evidence of that, but there is not. And the one question that was asked where they were trying to get to that, there was an objection and it was sustained. So it's what they had in Bloss, they do not have here.
Would the testimony in Bloss have run afoul of 803.8, or is it that person was not a law enforcement? What's your view about that, or would we have to overrule Bloss with regard to the scope of the 803.8 preclusion of police reports?
Well, there is the fact that you got him on one ticket, so you might give him a break on the other, but not going there for the moment. You know, the indicia of reliability in that case might have been sufficient. I think the most significant is the contemporaneously, but the other is that 3 days earlier he had done exactly the same thing.
So are you suggesting then that the second under Bloss, or even under these types of circumstances then, if an officer testify as to his habit, then he could, this would come in anyway?
It can't be habit alone. There has to be some memory of the event so that there can be cross-examination. And if in Bloss there was absolutely no memory, you know, I didn't read the transcript in that case, I only read the appellate opinion, then it's possible that the citation would not have withstood the confrontation clause. I mean, obviously, Bloss was decided far before Crawford, far before the cases, the Hawaii cases that have been decided since Crawford. And
did Bloss even consider the public record overlap? I mean, is there even a discussion of public? I mean, how is that a precedent in terms of?
Well, I honestly don't know what was argued in that case, Justice Pollack, because in the decision they ruled that it was under 406 as to habit and practice that the officer was allowed to testify about the second citation.
Right.
So it didn't come in. It's really not on point with this case. And that's the dilemma, is that in a case like this where we are going solely on what the officer remembered, and when it comes down, you know, I think the court needs to really examine, really scrutinize the issue about the judge's finding of credibility, because at one point the judge, after the officer has testified and the defense makes a motion to strike the testimony, the court says, okay, I'm going to deny that, but I'm only going to give some of the reasons because it'll be repetitive to what I say at the end of the case. Because he'd already decided the case, even though the evidence was not concluded, the defense had presented nothing, there had not been closing argument. But just as he prematurely decided other matters, he had decided the case.
Before you sit down, if I could ask you about the circumstance in which there's a videotape. And I'm videotaped, for example, of the SFSTs, okay? If there was, and then the testimony of the officer in attempting to lay a foundation was, you know, I don't really remember the incident. And if the officer is in the video, and it's clear that the video was taken at a certain time, I assume that you would concede that that would be admissible, despite the fact that the officer doesn't remember the incident.
I don't know that we would concede that. It, honestly, Justice, it would depend on what was depicted in the video, because for an officer to say that a video would not refresh his recollection when he could see himself doing the things would certainly go to his credibility. And unless the video was so clear that you could see absolutely every part of the test, every step up, every hop, etc., which seeing the videos we've seen from dash cam seems doubtful, I don't know that we would concede that. And I don't
Very
want
well.
To take it anymore.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Arnett. Mr. Vincent, your argument.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning.
In terms of our office, it's the constitutional question is most important to us. So I'm going to start with that, if you don't mind. Also, the question of whether or not the public records exception usurps and basically cancels the prior recollection recorded exception. That's very important as well. With respect to the confrontation clause, the constitutional clause, I would just read to you what Crawford versus Washington says in footnote 9. Of the main opinion. It says, finally we reiterate that when the declarant appears for cross-examination at trial, the Confrontation Clause places no constraints at all on the use of his prior testimonial statements. And I think that's basically what this court has adopted in State v. Fields, where we had an excited utterance exception. We had the declarant come to trial, and she testified that she had no present recollection of having made that excited utterance, but it was admitted into evidence because she was there on the stand available for confrontation.
But what about Nafoa? I mean, I understand what, as you know, I mean, by your reference to Filson, we're not bound by Crawford, as long as we give the minimum that Crawford...
That's correct.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And in NAFOA, we said that, quote, that sufficient cross-examination was required to determine a confrontation clause inquiry. And then we stated that confrontation clause required, quote, sufficient and meaningful cross-examination. Was there sufficient and meaningful cross-examination in this case?
There was the opportunity for specific and meaningful cross-examination.
But do we have that? Have that, it would seem to me, a limiting adjective to say that an opportunity, is opportunity for something the same thing as a sufficient and meaningful cross-examination?
Just because a defense attorney doesn't engage in actual cross-examination doesn't necessarily mean it didn't have the opportunity or didn't have. Sometimes they don't want a cross-examination, the declarant who's on the stand, because they're fearful that the answer they get may not help their case. So it's not always going to be productive.
Well, let me ask you this. Is there an opportunity for sufficient and meaningful cross-examination when the witness says, I don't remember any of the events that
have
just been admitted?
Yes, and the reason why is because at that point, if we're relying on the past recollection recorded exception, the defense attorney can ask questions like, isn't it true that you write sloppy reports all the time, or that you falsified reports in the past, or isn't it true that you have some ulterior motive for not recording your past recollection correctly? Either you don't like the defendant, or you just want to increase your stats by having more, So I mean, the attorney in this case could have asked either of those two lines of question. But I think he didn't because, because the defense attorney admitted on the record that he thought the officer was an honest guy, right?
You know, what we said in NAFOA doesn't say any cross-examination. It says meaningful cross-examination, and meaningful means about the specific events that are going to result in the person's possible conviction.
Well, I think it's meaningful to ask them what kind of report maker that they are with respect to, did they record correctly what they recorded on their report.
In that line, Mr. Vinson, in considering meaningful, it seems from the government's brief that there is a point being made that these reports have particular reliability, the FSST's reports, particularly with respect to this witness, because the witness was qualified as an expert and because the witness has done lots of reports previously. So is this part of the reason why you're saying that there is a meaningful opportunity because the reliability issue is relevant?
I guess I won't answer your question, but the fact that he did do it so many other times gives them opportunity to, from other cases, determine whether or not he recorded, whether he recorded what he actually observed correctly or not.
Well, Mr. Vinson, I'm sorry, go ahead and finish.
Was that your question, Ray?
I'm still reaching to try to understand where you would draw the line in terms of meaningful opportunity to cross-examine. For example, in your view, then, would it be sufficient for the, let's assume that the officer and the government decided they didn't want the officer to read the report, because, in this case, essentially, you want to use the report, and the idea would be to just admit the report?
Well, the past recollection recorded exception doesn't allow the report to actually be entered into testimony unless the opposing party asks for it to be entered into evidence.
All right, so you would concede that in this instance you're suggesting that it's admissible to have the officer read the testimony, essentially, of the report, but it's not admissible if the request of the government is to actually admit the report. Is that right?
Well, if the opposing party makes the request to have it entered into evidence, it may be entered into evidence.
Well, I wasn't suggesting the opposing party wants to use it. I'm looking at it
The state would not have that option to enter the report itself and it.
But then aren't you sort of accomplishing the same thing by just having the officer say, look, I don't really remember, but, you know, I'm very dependable and also I'm an expert, so I will now read my report. Aren't you sort of accomplishing the same thing?
Well, I mean, the fact that the defense attorney has an opportunity to cross-examine the officer on what he reads into evidence is assures generally what he said, the report said, is going to be correct.
Well, as he's reading it, this is somewhat reminiscent of this case. As he's reading it, and defense counsel is maybe having the opportunity to cross-examine him while he's reading it, and he says, I don't know. I don't remember what happened, so if you're asking me what my recollection is, I don't know.
We wouldn't ask him that. We would just ask him.
I'm just saying that it's difficult to see how the cross-examination would be something that would be useful if the officer just keeps saying, I don't remember. I'm just going to read to you what happened, but I can't tell you anything about what actually happened other than just reading the report.
Yeah, but as I go back to those two lines of questions as to how good a report maker you are becomes the issue.
So then,
not whether you can remember what happened in the past event, but
I'm wondering why, if under 803B8, the public records exception, even though a declarant is available as a witness under the rules of evidence, matters observed by police officers would not come into evidence under the public records exception. And even though, so under Rule 804, a person who lacks memory is considered unavailable, and even though if an officer is unavailable, what he perceived could not come into evidence under any of those exceptions under an unavailability, then why is it then that all of these things that specifically say a police officer's testimony of what he observed cannot come into evidence, how can it be trumped by past recollection recorded for police officers?
Well, they're both independent. They're both independent exceptions, and the public records exception. Well, and the public records exception and the past recollection recorded exception are both statutory. They're not constitutional.
Right. But didn't
so,
we?
So it's a matter of what legislative intention. Did they intend by enacting public records exception to basically usurp and swallow up the past recollection recorded exception, at least to the extent that it applies to any kind of police report.
But didn't we reject that analysis in Schwartz where we said you can't get something in the business record exception if it's excluded by the public record exception?
That's because the business record exception is essentially commercial equivalent of the public records exception. And so it makes sense, I think, to say that no, you can't get something in under the, you know, the.
But isn't past recollection recorded also a hearsay exception?
It is, but it's a well-grounded exception. It goes way back, and I think as you know, a number of your questions to defense counsel indicated, is that you know, both present recollection refreshed and past recollection recorded are aimed at, you know, the type of high-volume situations exactly like this case where it's very difficult for the officer 7 months down the line to remember exactly whether and how many clues they observed during a particular part of the test.
But suppose it's not a high volume case. It's a murder that the officer observed, and he's called to the stand 4 years later?
I think that would go to the foundation rather than the constitutionality. The past recollection recorded, I think, exception is, I think, specifically aimed at high-volume type cases.
Well, I know, but it
where people routinely...
Right. I understand what you're saying, but it doesn't say that in the rules. So what if it were a case where it's a, you know, not a high-volume type case? A detective is going down the street and sees a witness is a murder but can't remember it 4 years later, 5 years later when it goes to trial.
Well, I wouldn't concede that it would never be admissible. I hate to do that and foreclose any argument on that in the future, but I think that the arguments for that would be much weaker, perhaps, than in this case.
But it doesn't have, I mean, you may say it's weaker or stronger. In fact, let me take Justice Nakayama's scenario or hypothetical and take it one step further. Let's suppose that police officer not only observed the murder or whatever, observed something around the scene. Suppose that the officer said that he talked to the defendant and the defendant made an incriminating statement. And then it comes to trial and the police officer says, you know, I don't really remember what he said, you know, but I did talk to him and my report said he admitted to doing the crime. Why doesn't that come in under the past recollection recorded exception?
That scenario is very similar to the two cases that defense cited in their application for cert, where there were two of them were involved witnesses, I guess victims who had made a statement, could no longer remember their statement. Another one involved a co-defendant who all could not remember the statement, right? And they attempted to bring those in, and the court, the appellate court in those cases said that there was insufficient foundation. They never reached the constitutional issue.
I'm talking about a situation, and actually my situation is close. I don't think the case was cited, and I can give the cite, but it was a case where the defendant was said to have admitted something, and I think the trial court admitted it. And just real quickly, it's because there's an independent exception for an admission, and the document itself was admitted under, they read from the document under past recollection recorded. So under that, I mean, how would the defendant confront a statement that the officer says was made, but the officer says, well, you know, I'm sorry, I forget the circumstances, but you know, that's what my report says.
I think you have two levels there. Number one, did the officer remember it? Number two, did the defendant himself remember it? And because the defendant is not on the stand, he's not able to remember the subject matter of the statement. So I don't know if you could lay the foundation for. I mean, I don't think he's there on the stand, right?
You don't need the defendant. If the officer says that there was an admission, there's no requirement.
By the defendant, right?
What?
By the defendant, right? You're saying that...
The statement was made by the defendant in the scenario. The officer recorded it in the police report. Now says, the officer says, I don't remember the statement being made, or I don't remember the details of it, but it's in my report.
I just think it's a drastically different situation than the situation we have here. The situation is that the officer that made the observations, the officer who wrote what he saw, annotated on his report what he saw at the time when it was fresh in his recollection.
For the purposes of 8038, the public records exception, and comparing that to 80214, does it matter that the officer is there testifying or not? In other words, is the exclusion in 8038 aimed primarily at situations in which records are put in without the officer even being present?
That's correct.
And why does that? Why would that matter? Why is that important?
Because the history of the Confrontation Clause goes back to 1600s, where letters were used, where statements by witnesses were presented at trial without the witnesses themselves being present accusing the defendant, and the officer had no meaningful opportunity to actually even talk to the out-of-court declarant, right? In this case, you have the officer in the room, and he's there. He's available to testify as to his.
Is there a case so holding that on 803B8, the public records exception precluding in criminal cases matters observed by police officers and other law enforcement personnel, that it does not apply if as long as the officer's on the stand? Are there cases so holding?
I'm not aware of any other cases that would say that the past recollection recorded statement it would be unconstitutional if used by
I'm not talking about the Constitution. I'm talking about the rule. Is there a case saying that as long as the officer is on the stand, it doesn't really matter, even though 803B8 says in criminal cases, matters observed by police officers cannot come in under the public records exception. As long as the officer that wrote that is on the stand, it's going to come in.
I would assume that you couldn't come in under the public records exception even if the officer was on the stand under the public records exception. But I was unable to find any cases that would say that the past recollection recorded is prohibited by the confrontation clause, you know, if used by a police officer.
Well, and Mr. Vincent, if there's an independent witness who wrote a 252, that would and then came to trial and had no present recollection, that would still be able to come in because it wouldn't be an observation by a police officer.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What about the foundational issues? Again, the ICA sort of after the fact appears to have tried to argue or concluded that the record supported the application of the prior recorded recollection. Is the foundation there that, as Ms. Arnett said, where the officer said, yeah, I did this at the same time, and it's accurate. I try to be as accurate as I could. There's nothing like that in the record, is there?
Well, he says, numerous times he said, you know, if I hadn't seen that clue, I wouldn't have wrote it down, or if I had seen the clue, I would have wrote it down, right? So
he doesn't say it's contemporaneous, though, does he?
He doesn't specifically say it, but I mean, looking at the FST report, I mean, it would be hard to remember that thing for, you know, clues, those specific clues for a length of time. I just think that there's a reasonable inference that he did it pretty contemporaneously. I know one police officer we've had in court, he used to write it down in his hand, right? You know, and then he would transfer it to the FST report later. But it still was contemporaneous recordation.
But did he say it was accurate? Did he satisfy that foundational requirement?
He says, you know, if I hadn't seen it, I wouldn't have reported it down. If I had seen it, I would have reported it down. So it seems to me that he's vouching there that he's, you know, he just writes what he sees. That's basically, you know, the bottom line. And
this is something that the appellate court can consider, even though the trial court didn't. I mean, the trial court, you know, didn't make findings, didn't, you know, rule on this. And I realize generally we can affirm, or appellate courts can affirm based on anything that's apparent in the record.
Right.
But is this apparent in the record?
I would say that the foundation was apparent. I mean, when I looked at it, I guess going back to the present recollection, refreshed. The judge found that the first day he had present recollection, right? So, I mean, you can agree with that or not agree with it, but, you know, maybe he did, maybe he didn't. But the problem for me was that he didn't testify about the one-leg stand until the second day of trial. So by that time, I think it was pretty clear that he didn't remember it. At least at that point, which was 7 months after the incident, he didn't have any present recollection of the thing. So So, you know, I looked at the record. I'm thinking, well, you know, if he writes it down at the time he does it, and I know, well, I mean, I know how
but
these FSTs
Mr. Happen. Vincent, your point about how, I guess, observations made by an officer that are done routinely, in this case, it's in the context of these tests that are performed with for field sobriety tests, I guess, the SFSTs, but your argument that you can have adequate cross-examination because you can question the officer about how well he fills out reports brings up what happened in this case, because if I'm reading the record correctly, when defense counsel tries to engage in some cross-examination, which you might consider to be central to the case, for example, the degree to which the officer remembered the defendant walking, the judge says no, right? The judge intervenes and sua sponte says, no, this is not a proper question. And in this case, then, would you be able to come to the conclusion, given the degree to which the judge was limiting the questioning, that there was a sufficient foundation or reliability for these particular questions to come in through the past recollection recorded exception?
Well, I would see that the
I mean, do you see some reason why defense counsel wouldn't be allowed to ask that question about the question, do you actually remember that he stopped walking?
Well, I think that the reason why he stopped him there is because it was unclear as to whether or not he was, whether he could remember what he testified on the first day of trial, on August 1st, or whether he could remember what happened in the original
case. So it was an improper question unless he provided more foundation. The defense counsel provided more foundation by saying, let me ask you
right. In
the context of when you were asked the last time you testified, it was necessary for there to be a time frame established?
I think that was the judge's problem with the question, is it was ambiguous as to what the question actually meant.
Well, I'm not, okay, so but.
It seems to me, I mean, I didn't spend a lot of time on that particular issue, but.
So,
those facts.
I just, the district court judge, just to make clear, seemed to believe that the first day of testimony was based on personal knowledge.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And
just based on the witness's demeanor.
Demeanor, observations, the fact that the witness didn't refer to the report. But just to be clear, you are not relying on that theory now. And the reason for that is because, if I understood correctly, there are items that were not covered that first day that I guess the state would like to have considered as evidence?
Not only did the state like to have it considered as evidence, it appears from the court's finding facts in the trial that they considered the one-leg stand.
I see.
So,
aren't there several other problems? I mean, the second day of trial, the direct examination on the officer is no different than the first day. The officer just testifies.
Well, I mean, that's just, yeah, sorry.
I mean, it's just, there's mm-hmm. really no difference between, it's not until cross-examination does it become evident that the officer obviously had been reviewing the police report before the trial. I mean, the judge makes his finding at the close of evidence or something saying, well, you know, there's really not a problem here because he wasn't looking at his report during his testimony. And of course, you can refresh your testimony as often done before you get on the stand.
That's correct.
You know, in State versus, I'm sorry, go ahead. I'll respond.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm so sorry.
I didn't mean to. Yeah, no, that's okay.
In State versus Davis, we held that 803B6, the business records exception, generally cannot be used to circumvent what's prohibited testimony under police officers under 803B8, the public records exception, which says, you know, criminal cases, matters observed by police officers cannot be admitted under the public records exception. The Ninth Circuit has more clearly held that When public records are used against a defendant in a criminal prosecution, the public records exception is the exclusive applicable hearsay exception. It is the exception that speaks directly to the public records and carefully delineates the distinction between criminal and civil proceedings in order to protect a defendant's rights under the Confrontation Clause. Why shouldn't we adopt that holding?
Well, I mean, usually testimony in these kind of cases comes in under the prior, present recollection refreshed. Okay, so, and we just, I guess, make our evaluation of whether or not their recollection is truly refreshed. But once in a while, the officer, and I think it's understandable, don't recall the incident. And it seems to me that the record of the incident is just as reliable and also available, just as available as for confrontation as is the present recollection refreshed exception. So I don't see any reason why the present past recollection recorded should be just done away with simply.
But that argument would simply be, it'd be the same for public records. Why not just let them all in under public records?
Well, I mean, again, the public record exception is intended specifically for introducing public records when the declarant is not there, right? And I think it has swept in, you know. I mean, it has an additional requirement of that is that the officer has to be there, but for that. But
well, Mr. Vincent, in this case, the officer obviously was there, but I wanted to ask your thoughts about the extent to which him just being there was sort of what the defendant was left with and not really having much of a chance to be able to present the case, because getting back, I mean, you mentioned that you thought the judge stopped the questioning because he felt that the police officer was going to be confused, I guess, in his answer because the question wasn't sufficiently clear. But then shortly after that, in explaining himself, the judge says the question's not what he remembers today. Now, I thought you were making the point that you would concede that it is important for the defense counsel to be permitted to ask the officer what he remembers. Would you concede that? That's part of cross-examination, to ask the officer what he remembers?
That's correct. And
so when the judge says the question is not what he remembers today, sounds like he's sort of suggesting that, I guess, the question is what he remembered the first day testified, perhaps. But if the judge is under the impression that he's not supposed to consider what the officer says he remembers that day under oath testifying, to the extent cross-examination can take place, do you think there's an issue there about whether the defendant's getting a fair trial, regardless of whether this evidence is going to come in?
Well, I think that would be as applied challenge rather than just saying that past recollection recorded, it's just out, you know, we can't, please.
Well,
can't use
I mean,
that, right?
Just in this case, the evidence came in, but so what? If you have a judge that says, wait a minute, defense counsel, you can't question about the defendant, what you saw, what the police officer saw the defendant doing, and then after that says the question's not what he remembers today, what difference does it make what evidence comes in? Because it seems that the judge has said there's certain evidence he's not going to consider that's actually pretty relevant to the charge.
Yeah, I would just say my time's running out. I would say the record is what the record is. I mean, you know, and it was not brought in. It was not specifically, you know, was not explicitly. There was no. The foundation for past recollection recorded was not explicitly laid. It was ironically laid by the defense counsel himself, for the most part. And I had what I could do with that. But I would just ask this court to not find that it's that the past recollection recorded exception is unconstitutional as applies to policemen, because I think it's a useful and reliable and constitutional source of evidence.
Thank you. Ms. Arnett, your rebuttal. Oh, could you bring the mic? I'm sorry, if you could pull the mic down, sorry.
Yeah, I'm not quite that tall. I think it was Justice McKinnon, and I apologize if I'm incorrect about that, but I want to be very clear about my representation as to what the state conceded in their answering brief. And what they conceded was that he did not have any present recollection of the performance of the standardized field sobriety test when he testified on cross-examination, one. And two, that he could not remember whether he had any personal recollection of the defendant's performance on the SFSTs when he testified on August 1st. And that's curious as well. But we keep coming back to the situation where the court found him credible, but he can't even say some months later, when I testified on that day, I remembered everything. He couldn't. He said, I don't know. And he said, I don't remember what I testified to on August 1st, although he did acknowledge that he had reviewed his report again that day, December 15th, when he was being cross-examined. So there is an interesting issue about credibility. I also want to go to the issue that Justice Wilson was raising regarding the court's concern about the questioning, because the state said, well, the question was vague when the court intervened. This is what the question was. The counsel is saying, let's focus on the first nine steps of the walk and turn. You said he stopped. What step number was that he stopped on? I don't know what step that was. And this was the question. Do you actually remember him stopping? Or was that testimony based on what is contained in the report? And that's when the court steps in and says, I'm not going to allow you to answer that question because it's misleading. There's nothing misleading about that question. But that's...
Was there an objection to the question?
No. And then after the officer leaves the courtroom so they can have this discussion about what the judge means, so there's a discourse back and forth between the judge and defense counsel, and at the end of it, the judge says to the state, do you have anything to say? And she says, no, I have pretty good notes on the walk and turn, and if I need to interject, I will. So it was totally within her power to say, I object, Your Honor, that's because at some point during this discussion with the judge says to the defense counsel, I think you're asking him questions off the police report, and he thinks that's what he testified to on August 1st because you're making him think that. The state's counsel could have said, objection, misstates the evidence. Never did, because it didn't. And the court repeatedly did that. Then when the court made that curious statement about it doesn't matter what he remembers today, that kind of shows where the court's thinking was. And that's when, and at the conclusion of the officer's testimony, when the first motion to strike was made and the court denied it, and he said, but I'm just going to do limited remarks now because this will be repetitive with what I say in my remarks at the conclusion of the case. This was on page 29 of the transcript of December 30th, a 51-page transcript. Trial had not happened, and the judge had clearly made up his mind and already decided things.
You argued that.
Yeah, Ms. Arnett, I'm going to say your time expired, and certainly feel free to wrap up or make any final points but at this time.
Thank you. The point that we want to make about the state's and the court's reliance on these ambiguous and we would say simply fabricated or not there conclusions, that this is all based on demeanor, that he somehow could sense what the officer believed or understood about the questions from demeanor, that he could conclude, as he did in his findings. He says, I'm not really saying that the continuance is anybody's fault. I'm not casting aspersions, but it is a factor. Well, the continuance, one continuance, and the defense had said on September, on August 1st, I may not be able to make it on October 19th because I have circuit court matters. And sure enough, on October 19th, there was a trial call in circuit court, so that's when it was continued to December 15th. So defense, in the judge's mind, is responsible for that and then somehow responsible for the lack of memory of the officer. Our position is that a witness without memory is the virtual equivalent of an absent witness. You cannot cross-examine an absent witness. And cross-examination is the heart of trial. It is the opportunity for the defendant to hold the statements of witnesses accountable. And we believe this court should reverse the ICA's opinion and deliver opinion striking the testimony of Officer Ostachuk as to the results of the field sobriety test.
Very well. Thank you very much, Ms. Arnett and Mr. Vincent. The court will take this matter under advisement.
Please rise. The Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii.